Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Christina Hendricks. If there's one thing Christina Hendricks thought she would never be, it's a professional actor. And in fact, it took years for her to realize that getting paid to be an actor was an actual thing. But what she did want to be was an artist, and a suffering one at that. Ever since she saw the movie Fame, Christina was sold on a life in the performing arts. As she says, there was something very romantic and passionate to me about that idea of suffering for your art. It was about reaching beauty, and that swept me off my feet. It helped that she grew up in Twin Falls, Idaho, which may have been a small town, but the people there really cared about the arts and would turn out in droves for ballet performances and community theater. Christina got a rude awakening at 13 years old when her family moved to Fairfax, Virginia. Starting high school as the new kid is hard enough, but realizing that the thing you love, the thing your old town took so much pride in, is 100% not cool, must have been devastating. Luckily for Christina, embracing her individuality was much more appealing than conforming to what was cool. She began expressing herself in her fashion choices, much to her parents' and guidance counselor's alarm, wearing fishnets, combat boots, and goth makeup as a personal protest against cliquey conformity. That independent spirit is what led Christina to start modeling after high school, and later to pursue a career in acting, once she realized that that was something she could do. She came into public consciousness as the statuesque Joan Holloway in the critically acclaimed AMC series Mad Men. The show was a pioneer for hour-long dramas on cable television and earned her awards, acclaim, and steady work for 7 seasons. It also earned her a front-row seat to how reductive and cruel the media and public could be, often finding that any attempt to express her individuality earned her criticism and disdain, much like high school all over again, just on a red carpet. Well, Christina has left Joan Holloway in the 60s and is now playing a thoroughly modern woman, albeit a criminal, in NBC's hour-long comedic action drama series, Good Girls. Yes, it's hard to classify, just like Christina, and that's a good thing. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I have to say, before we get into the meat of all that you do, I am captivated by your singing voice. And I was watching Ginger and Rosa, and there's this scene where you're sitting kind of lonely at the bottom of the stairs by the fire, singing a song, playing accordion, and it's so beautiful and vulnerable, and it made me go back and watch other things that you sung, and I found the Mad Men episode that you sang originally, and I watched Stephen Sondheim's Company that you did, and I was just so blown away by your singing voice, which is sort of different than the characters that I see you play a lot.
That is the nicest thing you could have ever said, honestly. I'm very insecure about my singing.
Are you really?
Yes.
Well, we have an accordion here.
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding. No,
but even more insecure about my accordion playing.
Well, who's not insecure about their accordion playing? That seems like an instrument that when you pull it out, you're just opening yourself up to, shame and ridicule. Just by
so much ridicule and questions like,
right,
why?
Of
why?
All the instruments you could
why?
Pick.
Yeah.
No, but I was really surprised, and especially I think
The performance you do in Mad Men, your voice has this vulnerable quality to it that is not present in Joan's life at all. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, that's true. I guess it probably wouldn't... It would sound different from the Joan you think of. But in that particular scene, she was very vulnerable. You know, she was sort of put on display by her husband in front
right.
of his clients and made to sort of perform for him to make him right. look good. But it's funny, I was always attracted to the accordion because of exactly what you said. People are like, why the accordion? Because a lot of people think of polkas and that kind of thing. And I always think of Parisian love songs and
yes.
the carnival and like very sort of romantic.
La Vie en Rose?
Yeah, La Vie en Rose. So in Mad Men, they called me at home one day and said, one, do you speak French? And two, do you play the piano? And I said, one, I'll learn French if you want me to, because that's why not? And two, I play a little piano, and I said, but here's the deal. We've never established a piano in Joan's apartment, and I do play a little accordion, and it's very easy to just pop out an accordion rather than all of a sudden, like, oh, there's a, you know, a piano. And, of course, in the 1960s, it was much more popular to play the accordion than it is now. So it ended up being a perfect
True,
sort
yeah.
of fix for the situation, and they got excited about the accordion idea. So I got to practice that song, and I mean, I was still a beginner in it, but.
Did it feel, even though you're playing a character, that when you did that song, that not only the actors in the room, but the crew, did it feel like you were sort of more on display even than when you're acting?
Absolutely. It somehow makes you more vulnerable because isn't it odd that you could be an actor and you could act scared or angry or furious or amorous, which is all very, very, very vulnerable, but somehow it's 10 times scarier if you're singing.
Right.
I wonder why that is.
And I think being an artist, those are the things that I most want to see. Like, I want to be in a room where someone is going, okay, this is the thing that I really love to do, but I never show it to anybody. Or, like, those are probably the truest expressions of our humanness, and yet they're the hardest things to do.
But I think that, I mean, I know you're a music lover, and so am I, and I think that's why people fall in love with musicians, too, right? Because there's something about seeing their soul or something, you think you are. There's something that's being poured out emotionally
yes.
that happens with music.
And there's not the barrier of a character in front of you
right.
that you get to hide in. It's still you.
Yeah, you feel more stripped down.
Yeah.
And even though in those moments I was playing a character, it still goes... I mean, if I were to play a character, I would make Joan a really great singer. But it turns out I can only use Christina's skills. So Joan, poor Joan had to suffer from, you know, my limitations.
But then you get asked to do Stephen Sondheim's Company on stage at Lincoln Center. Like, the stakes must be raised at that point, too. Like how did you sort of, how did you square that with your own insecurities about your voice?
I mean, that was one of the most insane things I've ever done. I got a phone call, and my manager said, you've been offered, you know, part at Lincoln Center with Patti LuPone and Neil Patrick Harris. And, yeah, I mean, a list of extraordinary musical theater performers.
Right.
And I went, why do they think I can do that? What on earth made them, you know, what if they're hugely disappointed or what, you know, what, that... They don't have any representation of me singing. So I said, why don't we do this? Why don't I work with, I'll find a vocal coach in town and I'll work with them every day for a week. And at the end of the week, I'll do a proper audition for them. I'll sing for them.
So they offered you the part and you said, no,
I said, no, yeah, it's like the most backward like way to do anything.
Normally
I was like,
that.
I'll take it.
Because then it's like, It's not like you tricked anybody.
Yeah, it's like, listen, you saw it. So I did that, and at the end of the week, they called the vocal coach, and he said, I think she can do it. So I did it, and it was the scariest thing I have ever done. Even my dad was like, what were you thinking that you could just... He's like, you did an amazing job, and, you know, it was great. He's like, I would never have done that. And I said, there was something... I wouldn't have been able to live with the regret of having been offered that extraordinary experience with those actors and 10 years down the line being like, you know, they asked me to do that and I was too scared.
You know, that's so it right it. There, isn't it? Like you get these opportunities and it's that conundrum of it terrifies me, but how can I not?
I could either have the regret of not doing it or I'll look like an asshole, but I'm willing to roll the dice on looking like an asshole. So I did.
Could you describe the moment, like right before you went on stage the first time in a live audience? Like,
oh yeah, I remember so specifically because I knew that I was gonna be terrified. I mean, we only had 2 weeks rehearsal. One of my songs, I never even got to rehearse. So my second song, I'm singing with the New York Philharmonic in front of an entire sold out audience at Lincoln Center. I'd never had a rehearsal.
At ground zero of performing arts, Lincoln Center. Crazy.
I'm like, I'm getting nauseous talking about this. but we were, you know, hair and makeup ready in our costumes and standing backstage and, you know, they're doing the overture and I turned to my friend Craig Bierko and I went, oh, I can't feel my limbs. Like I could not feel my hands and feet.
Really?
I didn't know that's how it was going to manifest itself. That's how it did.
Did you have the thing where you were listening to yourself as you were singing? Like almost judging yourself as it was happening? Or were you able to just...
I think I more was having an out-of-body experience once I was on stage. I don't really remember any of that. It was sort of like... you know, just sort of being underwater. I remember there was a moment where Neil and I are at the front of the stage... And I do remember the stage lights, and I do remember thinking, oh, fuck, that's exciting. Like, being on stage and not being able to see the audience, but knowing they're there, and just the experience of theater. I remember that moment, and I don't remember much else. I do remember that, and I remember there was another scene where... Neil and I are under the covers in bed, and Chrissy Whitehead was doing this stunning dance.
Oh, right, they're all dancing around
you. Dancing around, and we were under the covers.
Are you having a little conversation there?
Yeah, we were, like, giggling, and he was, like, poking at me and kissing me, and, like, you know, we were joking around, which helped let my guard down, and he's a good friend of mine anyway, so he helped sort of, you know.
Yeah. Well, we got to talk about Good Girls, because this is a show that totally... snuck up on me. Honestly, I don't expect a network hour-long show with commercial breaks to be as layered or have as much depth or just to be as weird of a sensibility as Good Girls is. And it's you and Retta and
May Whitman,
and you play, May plays your sister, and the three of you are very, very close. And you end up basically robbing a grocery store and then dealing with counterfeit money in order to deal with your mounting debt and financial troubles. And I guess I was just curious if when you got this script, like, if it felt like new territory for you and something, because I would assume you'd be very careful after 7 years on Mad Men of like, wow, the bar is so high up here for what kind of show you do. I would think it would be easy to get a little spooked on how do I repeat success?
Well, it's interesting you phrased it like that. I guess that the thing, how do I repeat success? Because you can't repeat Mad Men.
I mean,
it's just
right.
It's so unique and so special. So yeah, it's very, very scary. And after we wrapped Mad Men, I did quite a few films and I did play around doing sort of guests on TV or things that I knew that it was sort of a limited commitment. I wasn't ready to just say...
Another 7 years.
This goes 7 years, I'm in, you know?
Right.
But when I started talking to Jenna Bans, who created our show, and the script was so good, and I was laughing, but it was dark, like you said, and I thought, but it's on NBC. And that scares me to death, because I've been living on cable for so long and so proud of being on cable. And I think in some ways we were sort of pioneers for cable.
Very much so, yeah.
And I was like, because this pilot's so good and so quirky and weird and dark, Are they really going to let us do this? Because I don't believe they're really going to let us do this. And I spoke to Jen on the phone over and over and over, because I was like, one day I was 100% in. The next day I was like, nope, I can't do this. Because
really?
I just felt like they were gonna trick us or something, you know? Because that they would unintentionally do it, that they would just go back to what they know.
Right.
And I just kept being reassured that they were like, you know, times are changing. And I thought, well, being a pioneer worked out really well before and made me really proud. So if I could help be a pioneer and jump back to network,
right,
and see if you can change the game a little bit over there.
What you're saying is that ultimately it's a leap of faith. They could have been. They could have been selling all of that to you, right?
And yeah, but you know, every project that you choose is a leap of faith.
What did you not want it to be?
I guess I wanted them to let them be complicated people, let there be real consequences, real issues and run-ins that would transpire if you were going into a life of crime, instead of it being cutesy. I didn't want it to be like, come on, girls.
Right, lady
like,
power.
Yeah, yeah, like pow, cow, you know, like bright pink font, you know, like I didn't want cheesy music dropped in, and I wanted it to still be fun and have energy, and it be on, that you're taking a ride with these women, and I want it to be fun enough that you feel like you are on it actually with them.
Right.
But that you can't go, come on.
Right, you can't be like,
would
that
never,
would
you know.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I didn't want it to be that. And I think that we've done it well. And it is a tightrope, because it is comedy and drama at the same time.
Right.
So.
And did you have any personal insecurities about that? Like, am I funny? Can I, you know what I mean? Like,
first of all, I'm hilarious.
All right, well, clearly you're hilarious.
Everyone who knows me knows I'm hilarious. No, I'm kidding. But obviously that's my concern. I think that's always people's concerns, because drama is drama. People enjoy drama. It's maybe more straightforward. I think there are different styles of comedy that people respond to. And I've always enjoyed comedy that comes from a really real place. I think if the writing is already, the circumstances are already absurd, and if you play it as real as possible, it will be funny. And I wanted to make sure that was the kind of funny that they were okay with. You know, that I wasn't going to do a waka waka kind of like, you know, and you know,
it's
like I didn't
Aussie
want, yeah, it was almost like what we were talking about with doing the singing. It's like, you guys know what I, like my approach, right? I don't want you to think that you're going to get something that you're not.
You want to make sure that the show you want to make is the same one they want to make. And it's
exactly.
Hard to really know until
yeah.
You start making it, right?
Yeah. You have to have a million conversations before.
Right.
And we did. And they said that's why we're interested in working with you, is we want this to be grounded and we want it to be real, and trust us, it will be quirky enough and strange enough that it will be funny.
Did you worry at all about, or do you believe in chemistry in terms of before you started working with May or Retta, did you worry that, oh, if we don't have chemistry, then this thing doesn't work? I guess I'm asking how you sort of suss out the chemistry side of it and feel like, okay, I'm with the right cast.
I don't think you can know.
You can't.
I don't think you can know until you're there. And I have worked with people in the past that I had no personal chemistry with, personal at all, and some of my favorite people to act with. And we had tons of chemistry on screen.
Really?
So
there can be on-screen chemistry that the minute you yell cut, it's like...
Yeah,
really?
Apparently. But you can't know that. And I think if you're doing your job and you're a good actor and you take it very seriously, you will find that chemistry. Just so happens, I can say fucking on here, right? I fucking love May and Retta. They are the coolest women. And I personally, I'm seeing May tonight. I had dinner with Retta last night. Like, we are genuinely friends, and we really enjoy each other, and we really do have each other's backs. And they are fine, fine actors. So I'm incredibly lucky. But I don't think you can know until you're until you've signed the papers and you're on set and you're working, I don't know if you can know that about that chemistry beforehand.
Yeah, it's funny to think about that, because I think about Mad Men, and after doing that for 7 seasons and having a way to work and knowing what, when good writing and good chemistry and a good showrunner comes together, it's almost like, well, how are we going to create that again?
It's hard. I mean, we got spoiled. We got spoiled. The other actors were phenomenal. The writing was phenomenal. Our crew was unbelievable. I mean, it really was a perfect storm. It was, and there are moments when you work on other things and you go, oh, I wish I was doing the scene with John Slattery.
Right.
It would be so great to work with John Slattery today. And then you're on a new project and you do a scene with someone new and you go, oh, that felt just as good as when I worked with John Slattery.
Clearly, and, John Slattery is the key to the
whole
thing.
He's the creme de la creme. Come on.
He's the Bananas Foster.
He's the Bananas. Yeah. You're the tops. You're the Bananas Foster.
Well, it does bring up another question for me, being a non-actor, of when you play one character for a long time, like you did on Mad Men, is there a shorthand that comes up for you of, oh, I know this character, I know how she would react in this situation? Like, is it almost like you have to relearn acting a little bit?
Certainly, on something like Mad Men, you know, when you're in season 4, when you read a script, she has a history. This woman has a history. And she has relationships and ex-boyfriends and ex-husbands and children, that every word she says, all of that comes with that line.
And you know all of that history.
And I know all of that.
Yeah.
And I've lived it with her. So it's as if Christina's responding to something. It's all the stuff that I've got. And I've got all that juicy, wonderful material for Joan.
Right.
And that's one reason I love television, is by season 6, it is so layered and interesting, and there's so much information in your mind. Sometimes it's funny, a new director will come on and go, well, maybe they would react like this. And you go, yeah, but remember in season 2 when this, this, and this, and this? And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they're like, oh, God, I didn't watch season 2.
So it's fun to have all of that. And yeah, when you start a new project, you have to make all the decisions, you know, in that moment.
Right.
And that's sometimes daunting, because when there's a million choices, it's hard to choose which ones you want. You've got to narrow them down.
Yeah, you're right. By season 5 of Mad Men, all those choices have been narrowed down.
Yeah. Joan's afraid of this. Joan's favorite dessert is Bananas Foster.
Right.
You know, her middle name is this. She once visited, you know, those all inform how she reacts to any, you know, circumstance.
I read something you said about looking for clues in a script, and I think you were referring to how you started with Joan and how she walked informed her. When you read a script, are you trying to find little phrases or words that make a character three-dimensional?
Absolutely. When I read the script the first time, I think I read it as a story, but every once in a while, I'll get sent a script where I've forgotten, or maybe I don't know which character they intend for me to look at, which is also interesting, because then I'll just read it and think, now which one do they want me to be, or which one do I respond to?
Right.
And sometimes it's not the same one, which is also interesting, where I find myself like really connecting to a certain character and then find out, oh no, they wanted you to play the other, and I'm like, well, maybe they should think about me
right.
in the other one, because that's the one that I'm finding myself embodying, you know, as I read it. And then if I decide to do it, that's when I go back. And all of a sudden, things that I read before, I'm like, oh, well, that changes this other scene entirely. If the intention is this, and you really have to break down all those things. I would call it looking for clues.
I think Mad Men is a weird example of that. And I wonder if that was an especially hard task to take on a period, because you're not just looking for your own character's clues, but you're also looking for what's not allowed or what is inappropriate for the time or whatever.
Yeah, there were a lot of rules. One, we didn't deviate from the script at all.
You didn't.
So the words that you saw on screen were exactly as they were on the page, which is helpful in many ways. One, because he's such an extraordinary writer. But two, you can't abbreviate and use slang and emphasize words in a way that we do in a modern way.
You can't sort of improv it and trust that that'll
work. Yeah, you can't say gonna da 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 da. Joan wouldn't say that. She would say, we're going to the... So it becomes a more proper thing.
Right.
Early on, I did a lot of research and reading about what a modern woman going into the workplace is expected to be, look like, act like.
Right.
The way you would sit would be very specific. And the way you would present yourself to men as opposed to women would be different. And the things that you would have on your desk would be very specific. You would have candy and you would have things because you want a man to feel like he could stay longer and have something for him. You know, all these little things, like you would show your slip maybe a little bit because it's tantalizing for your boss to see something like that. So you start to incorporate all those little things that are her, Joan's rules at work.
Right.
And then she can be a different person when she's with her girlfriend. She can be a different person at home. But there are certain things that you're like, well, a woman would never do that or would never expect that in that time or in that environment. And sometimes I do see period pieces now that take place in the 50s or 60s. And as beautiful as they are, sometimes I just go, that person seems too modern to me.
Like, there was so much work that went into that show and making it accurate and time accurate that it makes you able to spot that easily.
I mean, if you do it for that long,
right,
with someone as meticulous and rigid as Matt Weiner, who I think is incredible, and sometimes incredibly frustrating to be in that environment because you just want to break out and say, trust me, let me do my thing. And he's like, but trust me, let me do my thing.
Right.
But then you see the result, and it is so beautiful, and I appreciated the rigidity of all that.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here to talk about your teeth. The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and most of us forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. But here's where Quip is really unique. Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And I'll have you know, I took my teeth to Idaho a few weeks ago, and I took my Quip toothbrush with me, and it's all true. It sticks to the mirror, and it becomes a cover. It's pretty neat. And finally, everybody loves Quip. They were just on Oprah's O list and named one of Time's best inventions. And Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day, myself included. So here's the deal. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first free refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So I'm going to call out to all the off-camera listeners to try Quip out. I use it every day. I'm assuming that you all have very nice teeth and you want to keep them that way. So give it a shot. And know that when you get a Quip toothbrush and try it out, you're not only taking care of your mouth, but you're also supporting Off Camera. So go to getquip.com/offcamera. And remember, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. So it's spelled getquip.com/offcamera. So try it out and send me an email. Tell me what you think. And now, if everyone has brushed their teeth and has their PJs on, let's get back to the show.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your upbringing, because I'm fascinated with where the impulse starts that leads people on this path to where they end up having these amazingly creative lives. And it seems like, from what I read, that you had a pretty tumultuous upbringing. Like, I read when you were young, you were a ballet dancer. And when I think of, like, ballet, I think of fame. You know, like.
So do I.
Oh, you
do?
That's
my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Well, the thing about fame that always struck me is that it got to the nerve center of how desirous a career like that was and how disciplined you had to be at a young age and how hard it was and how much suffering you went through. And that film was so good at showing the suffering. But it made me wonder if when you were young, if you were driven in that way in terms of, I'm going to be a dancer and I'm going to be on stage in some capacity, or was it just fun?
I started dancing when I was quite young, and I could have just been a kid who went to ballet class and went home, but there must be some weird thing inside me that makes me an artist, or those of us who choose to do this, that I couldn't just be a little girl dancing. I had to get so passionate about it that the bleeding toes and the taping of the feet and the aching bones and all that became very romantic to me.
Really? Even at a young age?
Yeah. Like, it makes me, now I've never really thought about it in that way, but I really romanticized the hard work and the discipline and the struggle. Like, I wanted to be a suffering artist when I was, like, 9.
You did?
Yeah. There was something very, very romantic and passionate about that idea to me. But it was about reaching beauty. There was something about that that swept me off my feet.
And did that sort of give you an identity as a kid at first? Like, at that age, was that your reason for being?
I think so. I think I was a very dramatic little kid because I remember my dad like rolling his eyes, and all of a sudden I was reading poetry and I was into Anne and Green Gables, and it was like, you know, I had the torn up toe shoes next to my bed, and it was like, I don't know where I got this. I was living in Twin Falls, Idaho. It wasn't like I was hitting the mean streets of New York to be an artist. I was like 8 year old in Twin Falls, Idaho. I don't know where I got this notion. I don't know.
What struck me in reading about your history was that you moved at, if I have this right, at age 13?
Left Twin Falls, Idaho at 13 to move to Fairfax, Virginia.
Okay, so I have girls in middle school, and I know that that's like the time when everything's changing, mm-hmm. and everything's an emergency,
yeah,
and everything's dramatic, yeah. and all those things. That seems like a crazy time to move. And I was curious how that coincided with ballet, and how did that all dovetail together into like your tumultuous high school period?
Yeah, well, I was really happy living in Twin Falls, Idaho. I started doing community theater, so it was the first time I'd ever done theater in my life. I was dancing every day.
So you were living the artist life in Idaho.
I was living the artist life in Twin Falls, Idaho.
You but probably I had the poster, the ballet shoes.
Oh, for sure. The calendar with, you know. But that community was really supportive of arts. I mean, if there was a play in town, the whole town went to go see it, which is rare for a little small town,
yeah.
you know. They really appreciated it and celebrated it. So it was cool to be an actor or a dancer. And then we moved to Virginia, and I was going into high school, so it was the first time that I could take drama as an elective course. You know, it was always a hobby outside of school. This is the first time I could, like, check that box, like, I'm going to be in the theater department. I was so excited. I mean, I got to do it. I was going to get to do it every day. This was, like, the best thing in the world. And I continued to study dance. The best dance school was, like, 2 bus rides away, so I started doing theater in high school, and then afterwards I would take 1 bus and transfer and then go to another bus, and I would study dance every afternoon with a bunch of people I didn't know because I was the new kid, you know, I'd moved. Only to find that it wasn't cool to be in theater in Fairfax, Virginia. And no one really gave a shit if you were a dancer or not. Nobody cared. But it was definitely 100% not cool to be an actor and be in the drama department. It was made known very quickly. And I was like, wait a minute. I finally get to do this, and it's like people are making fun of me and the other people in the class, and I'm not really sure why. And I was just completely confounded. I just didn't get it. And I was already kind of a quirky little dresser and kind of an odd little bird anyway. And then I'd never been exposed to punk kids or goth kids or mod kids or something. So all of a sudden I was exposed to all these different styles and genres and stuff, and I was like, ooh, that's cool, and that's cool. And I was getting into certain music, and, you know, you sort of reflect the music you're listening to or your personality through that, you know.
And, right. And we've already established you were very dramatic and looking for the struggle.
Yeah, such a ham. Yeah, and clearly a romantic, dark soul in there somewhere. So, like, being a goth girl just was like,
that
I was like,
identity.
I found it.
So you were, like, in high school, you're dyeing your hair, I'm assuming
acting
there's
up
some
a storm.
Dark eyeshadow happening.
My makeup wasn't dissimilar to, like, Mad Men. I mean, I always had that little
cat
eye, you know, but I had black lipstick and, you know.
And so were you sort of made to be a bit of an outcast and embrace that?
Yeah, I think I wanted to make sure that the kids in the school that I found upsetting or cruel or mean or judgmental, I wanted to make sure that they knew I was nothing like them.
Okay.
So it was a way of setting myself apart.
You weren't going to go along
to get along. It's like,
you
might make fun
of
me, but let it be clear, I am not an asshole like you.
Right.
You are the asshole. I am just different. You mind your own business and I'll mind mine. I'm going to go hang out with my buddies over here and we're going to paint pictures and put on scenes.
Right.
And we're going to just, you know, be real rebellious about it.
And how did that go, like, in terms
not well.
Of... Not well.
No.
So how was home life compared to... Like, were your parents aware that it was tough at high school?
Oh, they were aware.
They were aware.
I'm pretty vocal. I don't really squirrel things away. I wear my emotions very out loud. But it was hard for them because they were having a tough time in their marriage anyway. And so they were struggling trying to fix whatever was going on with them. My brother and I were depressed because we'd just moved and left all of our best friends behind in a very happy place that we really, truly loved to come and be sort of bullied and see our parents fight. And then my brother went off to college, so then it was just me. And I was becoming increasingly stranger-looking as far as my parents were concerned. So they were, like, desperate, not knowing what to do, and just don't hang out with those kids. That was, like, the solution, even though they were the good kids, you know? Like, at the end of the day, they were the good kids. But we didn't look away that they understood.
Right.
So it was conflict between mom and dad, and it got to a point where they were just upset that I seemed sad. And I figured out a way to do my final senior year of high school at college and get college and high school credits and still graduate but also get college credits at the same time. And it just got me out of high school. And my best friend and I, we went to the college and met with counselors there without even telling our parents and came to them with sort of a presentation with, like, pamphlets and literature and said, I can do this, I'll still get my diploma, blah, 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 blah. This is all you have to do is sign these papers. And they were like, I mean, you couldn't deny that it was a good plan. And they were just, they didn't know how to make me happy. And so they went, do whatever you got to do. And
really?
It was almost the moment I left high school and I started going to this community college, drive there myself, and no one was looking at me. No one cared what I wear, you know, what I was wearing or what I was doing. They had their own stuff going on. And as soon as I wasn't sort of being watched and bullied and all that stuff, I didn't have to, like, dress that way anymore, and I didn't have to. And I sort of just let everything go and just got to sort of start to discover just who I was and not, like, what group I was in or what I was expected to be or how someone thought of me. I just got, no one was looking. So if no one's looking, then you only have yourself to just start to sort of discover who that person finally is.
Right.
And I was turning into an adult. I was, you know, 17 or, you know, 17 years old.
What was the worst it got?
In high school?
Yeah.
I mean, I was depressed.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There were certain areas of school I couldn't walk because people would spit at me. I'd have my closet. What do you call those little closets?
Lockers.
Those tiny little closets.
Clearly you've blocked it out.
I get the sweats when I go into high schools now. I had to have my locker moved because I couldn't go in certain areas without... there were girls who would threaten me and
really?
in classes... One of my my high school counselor, who, you know, they're supposed to be protecting you on your side. I just remember I went to get my locker combination the beginning of the year, and she was a new counselor, and I'd never met her. And she was like, why are you dressed like that? And I was like, here we go. And I said, I'm just here to get my locker combination. She's like, you want everyone to hate you? You want everyone to hate you? And like started going off on me first day of school and just decided she didn't like me the rest of the year. And I tried to change some classes like any normal kid did, and she wouldn't do it. So I would go home and say, you know, to my parents, I really want to change this class, but my counselor, so they would call her and the next day at school, you had to sick your parents on me? You had to sick your parents on me?
You're kidding me.
I'm like, they're just my parents. That's what parents do. They help you change your class when your counselor won't do it because they don't like you wearing black fishnets and combat boots.
God, you know, it makes me so sad to think of how that time in one's life, and especially your example of how there's not that many places to turn to.
It was definitely upsetting, but I've always found an escape when I needed to find an escape. And I always found I always knew how to get out of a bad situation.
Gosh.
Like, as scary as it is, it's scarier to not do something.
Yeah. But it brings up a question about what is a healthier base for an artistic career. Is it having all this resistance to push against, or is it having a total support system?
Well, that being said, even though my parents were like, we don't know what to do, and she's sad, and we don't understand these crazy teenage emotions, they always supported me. They always told me I could do whatever I wanted to do. They always supported me. My dad was pissed I didn't go to college, and he said, well, whatever money I put aside for you for college, if you don't go, you don't get a penny. He was like, you've got to get an education, you know, what do you think you're doing here? I think it was up until like 3 years ago, he's like, so, you think you're over this acting thing yet?
Three
I was like, you know,
ago,
it's like,
after two
it's actually
Emmys
my like career, like it's not.
After how many Emmy nominations?
It's not my hobby, you know? Yeah, you think you got it out of your system? I'm like, no, I don't.
Isn't that a dad's job though?
It is. And he realized very quickly that, you know, once I got an opportunity, I went and modeled before I started acting professionally. And
was that part of the plan of I'll go model and that'll lead to acting? Like, did you have sort of a
plan?
Yeah.
No, I never had a plan. And I was going, and I had been accepted to Virginia Commonwealth University, their theater department.
Okay.
And that was the plan. And I got this opportunity to move to New York and model. And I didn't in any way think that one would lead to another. And I didn't even know that you could act professionally. I just thought
really?
I know. It's like, I don't know how it passed me by. I just thought I would do community theater my whole life and that I would love it and it would be amazing. And I would get a job and in the evening I would do community theater and that
right.
would be my group and I would be happy. But that being said, maybe it's because my father moved us around so much. I was used to, you know, going to new places and I got this opportunity to move to New York and I just, in my head, I was like, I just feel like moving to New York City is the better plan. I don't know what that plan is, but I feel like it's getting me closer to who I want to be or what I want than going and moving more south in Virginia.
Yeah.
Maybe if I hadn't been so unhappy in high school, if I'd been happy in high school, then maybe the idea of college would have been much more exciting.
Right.
And so the fact that I had already secured a place in the department also would have, but maybe the fact that I was so unhappy in high school made me, the idea of going and hanging out with more kids my age and another sort of environment of education that I wasn't super comfortable with, you know, made me flee the other way.
It seems like you have a real independent streak.
I mean, there are still times where I'm auditioning in New York and I walk in and there's all these dancers everywhere and there's actors and you hear someone rehearsing down and it's Fame is just like, you know, which I watch annually and make everyone that I meet that's new who's never seen Fame, I'm like, you think you know Fame, but you don't know Fame. And they're like, no, with the water. I'm like, that's Flashdance, also a great movie. It's not Fame.
People do mix up Flashdance and Fame.
I know, it's like, you know.
Yeah, Fame is the breaking windows. Flashdance is
the
water.
Leroy smashing the windows. But there is the part of me that looks around and is like, I'm doing that New York artist thing that I want to do, and you pat yourself on the back. And
yeah.
And my husband went to the Fame School.
He did?
Yeah. So sexy.
That's probably why you married him.
That's probably I tell him that all the time. I'm like, you are like Bruno and Ralph and Leroy all in one. All the characters.
What if he didn't really go there? He was making it all up.
Then he's a genius.
So when you're modeling, did you have a plan of, I have to transition this to something? Like, or did modeling, was modeling fine? Did you fit with that?
I really enjoyed modeling. I think for several reasons. I think one, I started when I was 18 years old, between 18 and 19 years old. Some girls start when they're 14 or 15, and I just think they're too young to understand it or
for sure.
manage it. And I had some really great teachers around me, some photographers that I had met that sort of schooled me, and they said, you know, at the end of the day, when you take off a sweater, you make sure you hang that up, and you make sure you're on time, and you treat everyone with respect, and if they want you to do this, and you do it. And it was save every receipt, every business expense, and I had a little bag, and I would put it in, and I would take it and get my taxes done, and my you know, I really treated it as a business immediately, and so enjoyed that all of a sudden it was allowing me to travel.
Right.
And
yeah.
I always sort of thought of modeling as like freeze frame acting because I wasn't the tallest and I wasn't the skinniest and I wasn't the prettiest, but I really enjoyed being thrown into a new environment, being put in some crazy getup with crazy hair and makeup and becoming that scenario.
So you were in your head sort of acting.
I was a good model. I was a really good model. Because I was willing to be an actor in those spaces.
Right.
You know?
So did it dawn on you, like, I should be acting?
Well, I was always planning on doing community theater. It was always in the back of my head. I mean, I really honestly didn't know that I could or would or had the possibility to do that as a living. I'd never met a professional actor. No one said that was something I could do. I thought that was for other people. I didn't understand how that happened. And I wasn't, you know, a famous model, but I was a working model. I never had to have another job. And I, you know, that was my job.
Right.
And I was living in London, and I wasn't working as much as I had been. And I called my mom, and I was like, I don't know what my next move is. And
you were over the hill at 26.
Yeah. And she was like, would you want to come with me to L.A.? And I said, well, I don't really know what I would do in L.A. And I said, I think you have to have a car. And she's like, you can have my old Buick, and I'll get, like, a new car. And I said, okay. And I was really into music, and I thought it would be fun to maybe work at a record company. Like, you know, I was like, maybe I'll get an internship. I'd love to, like, go out and scout bands and, like, work on record. You know, like I had this, you know, like, that would be something I'd be into.
So this is fascinating. Still no inclination that you're going to act.
I was real bozo.
Amazing.
I just didn't know.
No,
I mean, it was like, that's my hobby. You have to still get a job, Sam. I didn't realize that it was a thing. So I decided to move to Los Angeles, and I started, like, getting all these commercials, which I had done a few of other places, but most of the national commercials were being done in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I kept booking them, and I realized I was getting a little tiny, teensy bit of acting experience in that. Although if someone asked me what I did for a living, I would still say I'm a model. And through doing those commercials, my brother introduced me to a manager who looked at my commercial reel and said, I'll represent you as an actor. And I didn't really know what that meant. And I said, well, I feel like I should get some acting training. Like, I've never had acting training.
You never had an acting class?
High school.
So when he said, I'll represent you, you actually said, no, wait, let me go figure out how to do it.
And he was luckily kind enough to wait.
Wow.
Oddly, he also represented John Hamm at the time.
You're kidding.
And Paul Rudd. And he only had about 10 people.
He had an eye for talent, clearly. So you go into an acting class, are you feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm so behind, there's so much to learn? Or did you feel pretty confident about?
You know, I audited maybe 3 or 4 classes around Los Angeles, and I just found them so goofy. People were just in there, like, wailing and doing all this shit, and I was like this. I was like, I'm actually embarrassed. Like, I can't. This is not for me. I just couldn't. I couldn't respond to it. And I finally found someone where it was just scenes with other actors, maybe 15 people in a room, and she'd set you up with someone else, and you'd go work on a scene and come back, and she would break it down. I was just working on scenes, and that made sense to me. And I really responded to that. So I worked with this woman for that time. And it wasn't all this, like, breaking down and, like, holding hands at the end and revealing secrets and stuff. And I was just like, I don't know. And I was like, oh, you know, I really want to be good at this. I really want this to be, you know, take this really seriously. And so I was studying and I was watching something on TV, some film, and I don't remember what it was or who it was, but I was watching it, and I saw the actress, and I went, I can do that. Whatever she's doing right there, I can do that. Like, I can do that. And I called this manager who had been sort of patiently waiting for me, and I said, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to go and find an agent and see what happens.
Wow.
So I went and auditioned for agents.
And did that give you less or more confidence in terms of having to go out and all of a sudden be in auditions with other actors that had taken classes or wanted to do it all their lives?
You know, I'd been modeling for like 8 or 9 years. So I was used to being at these cattle calls with a bunch of beautiful women and getting rejection all day long. So it
right.
wasn't like...
So modeling prepared you for the rejection that you needed to go, I'll just go tomorrow.
And modeling's even more brutal because they just look you up and down. They're like, yeah, no.
Right.
Okay, I'll just take my pictures back and like, you know. This one you at least had to like do something and, you know, you had a little bit more of a chance. Of course, that's 10 times more brutal too when you actually do something and they still don't want you.
Right,
But it had prepared me for walking in a room, standing in front of a bunch of gazing critical eyes and hearing no and walking out.
Right.
And coming back and being resilient and doing it again.
And do you think your acting school really was all those early auditions in
school
a way?
School of life, baby. And I think traveling and moving all the time and observing people, and I think all of that was great training.
Well, it's interesting you say observing, and I wondered if you were naturally, from childhood, an observer, someone who would watch other people and try to figure out what they were thinking.
I think it's probably a combination of things. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, through this process, talking to so many different artists, a lot of us have moved around a lot.
Yeah.
And I think when you move around a lot, you've got to dive in, gauge your atmosphere, your surroundings very quickly, fit in very quickly. Kids dress different in this state than they dress in this state. They use these kind of phrases and they don't say that. If I say that, someone's going to laugh and they don't like that. So you get very, very quick learning these kind of things, you know.
That's interesting. By having to fit in or having to figure out where your place is because of all these new things, it sort of is good training for an actor.
Absolutely.
Funny.
And you can't help but compare, you know, walking around the town that you're in, comparing, like, looking just sort of at the people in the grocery store, how they are different from the last place you are, you know. So those comparisons help you when you're discovering a character or something. All those different memories, you know, come into play. My mother was a therapist, and she was going, she was getting her master's while we were in junior high. She would come home and talk about it a lot, so probably the idea of analyzing people or, you know, she would come home and talk about, oh, that person's obsessive compulsive. She was labeling different people, you know, because she was learning all these phrases and studying all this stuff.
Right.
Maybe some of that in the back of my head, the idea of breaking down someone in a way, maybe that contributed to some of that. I'm sure it's just all the different things that I was exposed to.
It must have been funny when fame hit all of you in Mad Men, because I would think that it would be much harder to be an observer.
I do miss that, I have to say. It's one of the things I miss the most about being a bit more anonymous is I love people watching and I love dining out on my own. And for years and years and years, I was able to do that, just sit at a restaurant and just watch people for hours and hours and just talk to someone at a bar. And it's a whole different experience now. I still do it and I still like it. But now there's like they're watching you and they're gauging what you're saying, and some people know who you are and some people don't, or some people pretend they don't know, and then you're playing that game of like, are we just gonna both be normal or are you pretending to be normal, and then you're gonna like spring some weird question on me, you know? It's a whole different game now, yeah. I mean, I've been extraordinarily lucky because I started my career, you know, modeling and then and doing quite a few television shows that were, I mean, my dad would always be like, well, you're almost there. You almost made it. I'm like, I'm on a network television show. I get paid to be an actor, and I go and I have a parking spot, and I go home and I get a check, and like, I'm an actor.
And well, I was just like, dad sets the bar pretty high.
Oh, man, he's tough.
He's like, Madman is okay.
I mean. But at the same time, they weren't really hit shows, so I really was, you know, able to stay, you know, pretty anonymous and stay under the radar, and so I was getting to work and be a professional, do exactly what I wanted to do, but still have a really normal life.
Right. Your dad's like number 25 in the Nielsen's. You almost made it, kid.
I know.
Better
I
come
mean,
home.
But
the library's hiring.
You jest, but... and then when Mad Men hit, it wasn't an overnight success, and it wasn't like overnight we were famous. It was this very slow burn, and people started watching, and so we got eased into being in the public eye.
Right.
It was like this little trickle. You got to sort of learn how to handle what the bizarre nature of what that is.
Yeah.
And then the show ended 2 years ago, and when you're not in someone's home every single day, it drops fast.
It does.
It's like...
they forget immediately.
Like, I have no idea who you are. Which is kind of nice again. So then you go through this... I guess what I'm saying is I've been very grateful because this stuff is also cyclical. And you never want to trust that one's always there. One, it's always going to be like this or it's always going to be like this. And it's been this ebb and flow that's allowed me to appreciate sort of all of those different phases.
Yeah. I feel like when the outside world... plays a role in defining you, or you hear about yourself third person or whatever, you can't help but feel a bit misunderstood.
I think there, during Mad Men and as it was gaining popularity, people saw Joan, which makes sense. You see the characters, and Joan is a very coiffed, put together, confident person. And I think that I didn't want to let them down, so I would do photo shoots where I would definitely sort of change my fashion and things to be more geared towards. And when I went to events, it would be definitely more sort of tailored and structured to reflect her.
You were constantly promoting the show.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very stylish and stylistic show. And
very
people
much so.
Wanted that whole atmosphere. I mean, they really thought that we would just sat around and drink cocktails all day long.
Well, it really did have an effect, I think, on the culture.
Right. I think because I was trying to sort of give people what they wanted or maintain that mystique or that sort of thing, then when people would see me, you know, in my jeans and like talking about gardening or something, they're like, you don't, like you touch dirt. I think everyone sort of turned me into this very ladylike...
Proper
ladylike...
Right.
...thing, and which I appreciate. But it was funny how I sort of fell into not wanting to disappoint.
I could see that. I could see the pressure of wanting to live up to the people that love your work, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, all of a sudden you're doing these red carpets and you're going to events and stuff, and people are just so critical and cruel about what you wear to a damn party.
Right.
And I would want to dress more like me, which was maybe a bit more romantic or whimsical, or maybe has a print on it, God forbid. I get just fucking destroyed in these magazines and these, you know, fashion asshole police and stuff. And you're like, can I just be a girl and put on a pretty dress and go and celebrate this fun thing that I'm doing? Do I have to stand there so rigid and worry that you're going to tear me down? And so I found myself not wanting to dress like me or like,
right,
like wear something that I actually really love. And I'm starting to be able to do that again. And I get criticized, but it's me and it's how I look. And I've always, you know, obviously chosen risky fashion genres throughout my life. So I don't know why I wouldn't just go ahead and continue to do it now. But it became very scary when there were sort of people out there and you would see yourself on a magazine and they'd be like, this was a huge mistake, Hendrix. Look at yourself. You're like, I like that dress.
I would think that it would harken back to high school. And it would like...
It feels like bullying.
Yeah. It would almost feel like man, I got all the way here.
Yeah.
I'm at the top of my craft, and it's high school all over.
Yeah. And these people who are, like, talking about it have really no more authority than anyone else.
No.
And I think they bully people out of personalities. I think there's, like, a huge lack of creative, interesting things that you see people go to events, you know. I miss a Bjork in a swan suit.
Totally.
Look, I want to see that.
That's the disconnect that I've never understood, which is we're celebrating these people because
they're artists.
They're unique. They're individual. They take chances. They take risks. Mm-hmm. And exactly what you said, you get on a red carpet and it's high school all over again.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it should be fun. It's amazing that as a grown woman, it's hard to, like, not feel the pressure.
You know, it's refreshing to hear you say that, because I think the work that you have done and the level that you have elevated your performance and your ability to transform an audience to is something we should celebrate and something we should, you know, cherish. And I think of it in terms of my own kids, where I want them to celebrate their individuality. I don't want them to go to school and be told that something they've done or said or worn is wrong and have them believe that because it's a mob mentality or something. You know what I mean? That's not why you got into this profession in the first place.
Yeah.
You know?
It's about expressing yourself.
Yeah, and think about fame.
Yeah.
Break some windows.
Yeah, go nuts.
And let your, let it all out.
Yeah. Well, you know I agree.
Well, listen, I have enjoyed talking to you and I've enjoyed your work so much.
And
I'm excited about what you're doing now. And it's been very nice to get to know you.
Thank you. So, thank you. This was really nice. I appreciate it.
Thanks for doing it.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I love talking to Christina and getting to know her a little bit more. You can check out Good Girls on NBC and also her series Tin Star on Amazon. And of course, you can go to Netflix and binge out on Mad Men, which is just as good the second time around, let me tell you. So check all that out and make sure you look up Christina's singing. If you go to YouTube and type in Christina Hendricks and Sondheim, you'll be blown away like I was. So check all that out. Hey, I really want to thank you for tuning into this podcast. And I love the fact that you can take this show on the go with you wherever you are, in your car, on a train, or as Dr. Seuss would say, on a boat or on a plane. And the truth is, you can take off camera anywhere, but please take a minute and check out what we're doing for the television show. Because if you haven't seen the television show, you really haven't seen all that Off Camera is. And I think it's a great way to experience the show. Not to say that being in a car or on a train or in a boat or on a plane is not a great way to experience Off Camera, but when you can see these iconic artists expressing themselves and telling their stories in 4K high definition black and white, it's quite a transformative experience. So I encourage you to check that out. Go to offcamera.com, get our monthly subscription, and try it out for a month. See if you like it. You can have access to every show we've ever done to watch on any device, anytime. Also, when you're at our website, don't forget to check out the store. We have this beautiful 275-page, four-color black and white coffee table book called Off Camera, The Portraits. And it's filled with every iconic artist that has appeared on the show. I don't know if you know this, but after we have our conversation, we go into my photo studio and we do a photo shoot. And it's my way to sort of complete the portrait of the person that I've just spoken with for an hour. And the book makes a great gift or just a great addition to any coffee table. So check that out and poke around the site and, you know, see what we're all about. And most importantly, tell your friends. Don't keep Off Camera to yourself. If you're enjoying the show, hop on social media and tell the world about it. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. So tell a friend, and they'll tell a friend, and they'll tell two more. You know how that goes. I want to thank everyone that helps with the show. We couldn't do a show without these people, and it really is a labor of love, and we work really hard. And these people are responsible for all this content that we're creating. So a big thank you to Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Sasha Snow, Michaela Galvin, Kara Johnson, and Matt Nine Toes Davidson. Thank you all for all the hard work you do. And make sure to join me next time when I sit down with songwriter and guitarist Jason Isbell.
I sat down and thought about deconstructing a love song. I was like, what is it? Really, why does anybody care about anybody else enough to make themselves this vulnerable and this open to attack from all angles at all times? And it's, well, this is it. This is all we get. We get this time on earth, and then that's it. We don't know what's next, if anything. So then it almost became a love song to death itself. After that, it was just, I knew I had a good song.
It's hard to describe why I fall in love with a song or identify with a songwriter, but when it happens, it's certain and permanent. Jason Isbell has a way with words in the way that artists like Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, and Willie Nelson do. They are artists that write sharp, specific, and personal lyrics that somehow become universal. Or, as Jason says, songwriters have to be willing to walk around with their pants down. But Kris Kristofferson looked pretty cool with his pants down. With every record released by Jason and his band, The 400 Unit, I am more and more convinced that we are witnessing a true talent whose songs will live on for future generations. High praise, yes, but as you will witness when you tune in, totally deserved. See you next time, off camera.